This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
This is Danny and Gallant, and it's a Friday. The best part about Friday is the weekend's right around the corner. The second best part about Friday is that Michael Bulpus is in here for Blue 42.
Here we go. This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Michael Bumpus, how are you now?
I am good, good, good. How are you, sir?
Doing wonderful this morning. Which NFC West team is going to take the biggest step back this coming year?
The biggest step back. Naturally, everyone wants to go with the 49ers because of the Super Bowl hangover. But I'm going to look at this situation just as of now. The roster's now. The situation now. The biggest step back. I'm scared of maybe the Seattle Seahawks.
Oh!
If they don't sign Clowney, if Chris Carson isn't healthy, if Rashad Penny isn't healthy, if Michael Kendricks doesn't bounce back, you're relying on Cody Barton. As of right now, it might be the Seattle Seahawks because of health and waiting to see what they're going to do with that D-line.
I do think everybody needs to be prepared for all of the statistically minded folks out there, which we now just refer to as the analytics community.
The chef people? The cooking people?
The cooking people.
The cooking people. We're going to explain that and just have Michael Bumpus tell us about the cooking people next. They're all going to be picking the Seahawks too, and they're going to point to two things. Their record in close games last season and saying that that's unsustainably good, and the point differential as being a sign that this team was not... It was... The way it played was more like a 9-7 team than an 11-5 team. They've got an opportunity to get better, but I don't think any of us doubt they need to make additions. This isn't a season about an off season about avoiding subtraction. They need to make additions.
Yeah, and I think they will. That's why I say as of now. You know, you got Britt coming off of knee injury. Upati struggled all year staying healthy. You don't know if Ifedi's coming back. There's just so many questions going on with this team that as of now, they might be the team. But what do the Hawks do? They find a way to get 500 draft picks. They bring in a veteran. I think they're going to develop rookies a little better this year. Those second-year guys are going to get a little more run. I think they will make the right moves to get out of that perception that they might be the guys to take the step back. But right now, you got to look at that team. I mean, the Los Angeles Rams, what were they, 9-7 last year? I think they'll get better depending on what Todd Gurley does. Arizona Cardinals were 5-10 last year. Kyler Murray's shown that he can play. And I think with the development of his coach, with Kingsbury, he's got his rookie year under his belt. He's going to get better as a play caller. And then with the San Francisco 49ers, man, you got Debo coming back. You got all your running backs coming back. You got Kittle coming back. And say what you want about Jimmy Garoppolo, he was really just a second-year starter. He played in 20-something games. His third playoff game was the Super Bowl. So I see him getting better as well. Will he get better? I don't know. This is all speculation. So 12s, don't beat me up, okay? I believe the Hawks can get it done, but as of now, they might be the team.
I don't blame you. And you know, you mentioned that injury deal. This is something that I've always been struck by. When you look at a team and what they go through over the course of a season, I think we tend to think that the next season the injuries aren't going to happen. That's sort of flawed logic, isn't it? Because every single year there are injuries that take place on a team, and you might think, hey, you have Justin Britt back next season. Wonderful. But who's the guy that gets hurt that ends up missing a significant amount of time?
Not only that, people will tell you what the number one predictive factor of injuries is having previously suffered that injury. Like, that's the number one. And it doesn't mean you're doomed to repeat it, but that having suffered that injury before almost by definition means you're more likely to suffer it in the future.
Yeah, and then once you get injured, things around that injury start to happen. You know what I mean? As soon as I broke my fifth metatarsal in my foot, now that knee starts to hurt on that side. So, I mean, it's the reality of the sport. Guys get hurt. Some guys recover. Some guys are never the same. So you got to wait and see.
I'm nervous about Chris Carson. I'm nervous. I know he didn't have hip surgery. That's a hip injury. He's a running back. That is the one that I'm concerned about most going into next
season. Don't lie.
Hips don't lie.
Hips don't lie.
Oh, yeah. Just ask Shakira.
Big up Shakira.
Shout out.
Question two. Funny that you should mention Jimmy G, Bump. funny that you should mention him. I said yesterday I thought I was done laughing at him, and it turns out no. Have you ever seen a quarterback throw an interception with his eyes closed?
No, I haven't. Actually, I lied. One time, I believe, when Peyton Manning was with the Denver Broncos, he saw he was about to get hit. He closed his eyes and let it go. But the way Jimmy looked, it was just comical, man. I mean, he's just giving us more material to judge him about. And it was that two-hand pass, right?
No, it was the other one. It was the actual interception.
Oh, the interception.
Where he's trying to fire it out of bounds.
Yeah, and he was trying to throw it away. And that's his knock, too. He does not throw the ball away. So he's trying to do the right thing. And he closed his eyes. He gets hit. He saw the heat coming. Poor Jimmy. He's not used to getting hit like that.
You can search online. Maybe we'll tweet out a picture.
No!
Omani Jones
had
a description of
that
it.
That was his idea. Somebody get this ball out of my head. That was his description of it.
Which I think sounds like when you see it, he was just like, ah!
Yeah, it was a hot potato. Get this thing out of my hand.
I really like the still shot that someone got of Jimmy Garoppolo with his eyes closed, and I just want to be like in Super Troopers. Enhance. 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 And just keep on looking at it and like dissect every single bit of it. Like the sad frown on his face.
He's got a tight frown.
It's a real tight frown. The eyes, the sadness and despair.
It's more like a blank. Like he's not squinting. He's not scrunching them up. It's just he has closed his eyes. He's like, I'm waiting for the pain that I know will come. And then he fires an interception. Yeah, it turns out I can continue to listen to all this stuff.
What did you think, by the way, of that interception he threw with his eyes closed?
I knew you were going to get to that. I knew you were. You know what? At the time, it seemed particularly egregious. And then when you saw the videotape, like the run back, the highlight, I was like, damn, he really did have his eyes closed. I mean, the idea that he had was like, all right, I'm going to quickly try and rope this out of bounds. But he clearly didn't put enough mustard on.
Let me tell you what idea he had. This is what his idea sounded like. Oh, no! That was his idea. Somebody get this ball out of my head!
Have you ever done anything on a football field bump with your eyes closed?
Never. Ever. I think you need to see the game to be a baller. And, you know, it's unfortunate for Jimmy. Maybe it's just bad timing. You know, at some point when you get hit, your eyes are closed. You're not, if anyone gets hit and you keep your eyes open, you're not a human, you're a robot. Something's going
on.
Or
a psycho.
Come on,
yeah.
Bump, be a hater. Come to the dark side.
Question 3. So Dave Wyman thinks it's weird that we're spending so much time talking about the offense this offseason.
Who was that?
The gentlemen of Bob, Dave, and Moore, they are very funny. I've enjoyed the grumpy nature with which they've looked at those who would like to let Russ cook, as they call the cooking people. What do you think about the way that they've been looking at this? Are they on the right track, or are all the skeptics about the Seahawks offense correct?
No, I think Russell needs to be given more, control of the offense. I think that you need to let him. He's in his prime right now. He's got about 4 or 5 more good years. I mean, he can probably play longer than that, but in his prime, he's got 4 or 5 good years. And you've seen one approach. You've seen the heavy run, rely on the run game, play action stuff. And what has happened? They haven't made it to the Super Bowl yet. They lost in the second round almost every year, it seems like, right? So why not try something different? Why not let him take control? Why not let him take control the whole season and just see what happens? I know you have some good running backs back there in Chris Carson and Rashad Penny, but it's time to switch it up a bit. The thing that scares me is that I don't think Pete Carroll will switch it up. I mean, he's 68 years old. He is who he is. You know what I mean? He's 10 years in the game. He's had success. So why would he change it? But I'm with the skeptics. I think that you need to let Russell throw that thing around. It doesn't mean he's throwing it 50 times a game. You know, it means that maybe you come out passing the ball first and second down. Maybe you give him RPOs to look at. Maybe you get him empty a little more and just throw the ball. He's responsible with the ball. I can see if he was a guy named Jameis Winston who goes 30 for 30, 30 touchdowns, 30 picks. You don't trust the dude. But Russell Wilson on and off the field has given you more than enough reasons to trust him.
I still don't believe there was a quarterback that threw 30 interceptions in 2019, the year of our Lord. Come on, 30 picks?
30, that's bad.
That's awful. I was reminded recently, and I'm not smart enough to think of this on my own, of the 2015 season. And that's the year Marshawn Lynch gets banged up. He has the sports hernia surgery. Thomas Rawls is the team's running back, and he comes in and he does pretty well. But they made a shift in the second half of the season of Russell going to throw the ball. And the ball's going to come out quick. And the 2015 season was that moment where Russell answered any question anybody ever had about what kind of offense he could run, where you're like, he can run that. We've seen him do it before, and they went on a tear that year, and Russell was, and that's the most prolific passing stretch of his career. It's the final eight games of 2015 are unbelievable. So they can do it. I wonder if they go back and look at some of that and say, I know it's not the way Pete would prefer to play, but man, it's hard to argue with the results of that.
Yeah, it's all about Schottenheimer. He calls the plays. You know, what's his philosophy? I mean, I don't know Schottenheimer's history as far as calling players or whatnot, but what I've seen out of him, it's more of like an old school, late 90s, early 2000s type offense. That's who he is. That's the type of offense that's gotten to where he is today. And again, I just go back to when you are in a position like an offensive coordinator or a head coach, you're going to live and die by what you do best and what you believe in. So why should we think that Schottenheimer and Pete Carroll are going to change now? They need to do an Andy Reid. Andy Reid is one of the most versatile coaches I've seen. He's changed with the game, and I think that's why he got the Super Bowl. He recognized, man, I got Pat Mahomes with a cannon. I got all this speed around me. Let's switch it up and spread it around a little bit. I just don't know if the Seahawks are going to do that.
It's the biggest problem with coaches in football. They just, a lot of them, I think, get set in their own ways once they figure out something that works, and they don't think that anyone's ever going to figure it out. Here's the deal. Everything in the NFL always gets figured out. It's only a matter of time. I mean, we saw it with Lamar Jackson eventually. I mean, Lamar Jackson in the playoffs, all of a sudden, hey, it didn't work out so well. Then he can't throw. All of a sudden, he looks like he did against the Chiefs early on in the year. But I do wonder about Schottenheimer, and I think we tend to blame him. I think it's easy. He's an easy target to blame, especially given his past track record before he came here, and say, oh, yeah, this guy's the problem. But I wonder if it's more than that. I wonder if there are some other people that maybe have their hands in the cookie jar, if you will, that are perhaps maybe making it a little bit more difficult for him to do exactly what he wants.
I think he gets parameters. I think he gets told, like, how much, hey, let's look to run the ball here. I don't think he has. He's calling the plays, but I think that there is some heavy input into the type of plays that are being called.
I do, and I wonder, and Bob, you've been on the sideline. Maybe you've seen stuff like this. I do wonder if maybe there's an element of Pete Carroll breaking the emergency glass, and on certain plays where Schottenheimer's called something that makes sense, then all of a sudden he gets involved, and then maybe it leads to, I don't know, delay of games that take place at the goal line.
Yeah.
It's a possibility. I mean, you got to think, all these guys are walking around with headsets on. You know, you think Pete Carroll doesn't flip over and say, hey, Shotty, we need to do this here. Let's do this there. So, I mean, I'm sure Pete Carroll has some type of input. He wouldn't have hired Schottenheimer if he didn't like what he did. So they got some type of chemistry there. I'm sure they're bouncing ideas off of each other. I mean, it just comes down to their relationship and what they want to accomplish. There are keys and goals they want to hit every single game. They sit down, they talk about, this is how we're going to attack this game. It's not like Pete Carroll's going into the game and just watching offense and say, all right, let's see what he does. He knows exactly what he's going to do in certain situations.
This is Blue 42. Michael Bumpus is in with us for the 8 o'clock hour. Pretty exciting to see what the Seahawks are going to do. We'll be interested to look at it. 24 touchdowns, one interception. That was Russell's stats over the final seven games in 2015. Pretty remarkable what they were able to put together. Bump, I wanted to ask you about Seattle's finishes. For the first 5 years that Pete Carroll was here, they always got better in December. Like, they hit their peak in December. You would see this team, whether it was winning their final five games in 2012, I think it was their final six games in 2014. Like, this was a team that would hit its stride. And we've seen over the past 5 years, they're not bad in December. They're just not as dominant as they used to be. In Pete Carroll's first five seasons, they were 17-7 in regular season games played in December. And over the past 5 years, they're 15-10. And that doesn't sound like a huge difference, but it's basically, they used to be a good team that became great in December and peaked in the playoffs. Now they're more like a great team up until December. Then they become good, and maybe they'll win a playoff game. What do you think's happened to them toward the end of seasons?
You know, I was driving up here, and I heard you guys touching this a little bit, and I forgot who said it, but I think it comes down to availability. Who's on the field at the end of the game, you know, and then you got age, you know, you got an older linebacking core, you got an older offensive line. So and then you have a defensive line that you haven't quite figured out yet. So I think it comes down to just age and injuries. And obviously this year they were plagued with a bunch of injuries. And Russell Wilson was asked to do a lot later in the games. And then you lose your running back. So you can't rely on that defense. You know, these past years in 12, 13, 14, 15, you could rely on the defense to bail you out. Where now it's like, okay, defense, just don't break. Offense, you have to do it all. And when you look at and it's weird because the Kansas City Chiefs is kind of like the opposite. They relied on their offense. Granted, towards the end of the game, their defense kind of stepped up. So you can't always say defense wins championships because obviously offense won this championship, this Super Bowl. But when it comes to the Seahawks, I think it just comes down to who's available and who's on the field. And I don't know the stats, but I would like to think that those years where they were great late in the season, they were super healthy.
There's definitely some of that. There's definitely like the availability of guys and who's there. The other thing that's happened, and looking back specifically at 2017, which is the year that they didn't, the only year with Russell Wilson they didn't make the playoffs, and then this past season, the one similarity is that in both of those cases, there was no running game. This year it was because of injury, right?
Right.
You lose your top three running backs. And that's not a product of age or experience. That's just terrible luck.
And on top of that, you could argue Joey Hunt being the center as well. Maybe they're a little less physical at the point of attack just because he's a smaller guy.
You had some extraordinary circumstances right. happen to your running game. In 2017, they just couldn't run it at all. They were awful. They were god-awful at running the football. No matter how much they wanted to do it, they couldn't. I think they had a net of zero rushing yards on like 12 handoffs in the 10. They did not have a running back score a red zone rushing touchdown. Like the only running back touchdown was J.D. McKissick and was from like 30 yards out. Again, they couldn't run at all. And what happened there was that so much piled up on Russ and he was asked to do so much, they kind of caved in on him a little bit. Like we reached the breaking point. Like, okay, you have to be able, somebody at least has to be able to do something. Kind of what happened in the playoffs this year, right? When Russell's accounting for almost all of their offense, whether it's rushing, he's their leading rusher in the playoffs, or it's passing. So that idea of health, I think, is, and how do you stay healthier? Cross your fingers is one of them. I mean, it's tough to predict injuries or say that there's any linear, but age does tend to make teams more vulnerable over the course of the season.
Yeah, and you got to look at the one-dimensional teams eventually sputter out. You look at the Baltimore Ravens. You know that Lamar was going to touch the ball 30, 40 times a game. Either he was going to run it or hand it off. He was so much involved in what was going on. Then you look at the Kansas City Chiefs, right? What are they known for? Passing the ball, slinging it all around. Damian Williams had over 100 yards that game. You know, so the teams who are one-dimensional. And then you look at the Seattle Seahawks towards the end of the year. Russell. Yes, he's being magical. He's making all these things happen. But, man, football is the complete team sport. And if a defensive coordinator can look at his offense and say, get rid of that guy and you're fine. Guys are going to figure it out. So with the health, with Chris Carson going down and then all the injuries on the offensive line and Russell having to be magical every week, man, eventually that magic, it just wears out. So it's Russell was asked to do a lot and I think performed at a very high level. But at some point, you got to distribute the ball.
You got to distribute the ball. Is there also maybe an element of you got to trust more people to put on the field? You got to say, hey, we got young players. Let's give them a little bit of seasoning, a little bit of experience early on in the year so that at the end of the season they can close stronger, as Danny, you've been laying out. And also, I mean, look, when you're a deeper team, guys are just rested. And in the fourth quarter, I mean, you're going to be a lot better. You're going to be in a situation where you're not, like, panting and bent over and gasping for air down the stretch. And we've seen how good the Seahawks have been at closing games, especially when the offense gets cooking. So I wonder, Bump, if this is something that they can do. And I also wonder, how do they get those young players to a point where they trust them and they actually are willing to put them out on the field?
And that's the thing. And earlier in the season, they were playing the young guys. I remember the first game, Ugo Amadi got the start at nickel, but then he gets cooked. You know, he gets beat.
A lot of yards by Andy Dalton.
So right. It's like...
Is that what the cooking people said?
Yeah, that's what the cooking people said. But then he scares you. And then you go, man, can we handle this? Because you look at the Hawks' first three games, it goes Cincinnati, a team that everyone expected them to beat by more than 1 point. Ugo Amadi doesn't have his greatest game. Then you go down to Pittsburgh, and Ben Roethlisberger goes out. He's still playing some young guys, only beat them by 2 points, and then you lose to New Orleans. So you're 2-1 coming out, and you're looking at these young guys. You're like, I don't know if they're ready. We got the Cardinals. the Rams and Cleveland after that. These are three games we need to win right now. So you put your old guys in, you go with the old school, and they pick up three games. So now you're like, you know what? Maybe we don't need these young guys right now. Maybe they can play the 2 and 3 spot and let these guys develop. It's such a week by week type of thing.
Yeah.
If Ugo would have came out that first week and had a game, he probably would have started the rest of the season. But he had his opportunity, and Pete's like, all right, the window's closing on this team right now. The window's closing on Russell Wilson. Pete's 68 years old. The window's closing on him. You know, you get into that panic mode. You're like, you know what? I'm just going to go with what I know. Let's put these old guys in.
It's interesting. That idea of sort of losing sight of the forest because you're so close to the trees, you can definitely see that. How do you guys think people in Baltimore are feeling? Like, they were a great team. They have the NFL MVP. He's a young quarterback. You're right in the sort of the prime window. You got your quarterback locked up for at least 2 and 3 more years if you really wanted to play contractual hardball with Lamar Jackson. Yet you're 14-2 and you get to the playoffs and you lose at home to a Titans team. I wonder how they're feeling, if there's a sense of, okay, we'll get him next year and that's just one of the lessons that we needed to learn, or there's a feeling of, if you don't get over the hump, then when exactly are you going to get over the hump?
Yeah, I think Baltimore is banking on the development of Lamar Jackson. Mm-hmm. Everyone says he can throw the football. He's an elite thrower. No, he's not elite, but he can toss the rock. Now it's about him taking the next steps. If he can take the next step in throwing the football and they can stay in that offense and yet they can get into that tight formation and spread them out, the more they can do, the better, right? One trick pony. You know, this wasn't a very versatile team. They were very good at what they did, but they weren't very versatile, and eventually they get figured out. But then you say the same thing about the Titans. The Titans throw the ball, what, 10 times a game or something like that? You know, so I think their next step is all about Lamar and then maybe getting a receiver or something that he can just, a DK Metcalf, that he can just toss it up. You know, he needs a guy who can just close his eyes, let it go, throw the deep ball.
Don't close your eyes. You're going to get it picked off.
Have you guys watched the Vic 30 for 30?
Yes.
Any of it? I'm fascinated watching it and bringing up Lamar Jackson now because I feel so much better about Lamar Jackson having watched the Vic documentary, at least the first part of it, and seeing, like, especially at the end of the first part, they go through his later years in Atlanta, and the guy's star just became too big. And he, I think, got into this mode where he really was enjoying life, and he wasn't really as focused as he probably needed to be as far as actually getting better at the elements of his game in terms of passing the football that he needed to. I feel like Lamar Jackson's going to get better. I think Jackson's got a pretty good arm. The accuracy thing, there are a lot of quarterbacks like that you can point that out with. But, I mean, I really do see some extreme similarities between Vic and Lamar Jackson. So I think he's going to be fine. I think he's going to take that next step. I think a lot of people are writing him off all of a sudden this offseason, and they're saying, oh, the last year's playoffs, we saw what he looked like as well. Get out of here with that. This is a great player. I love Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, I think he'll be fine. And one thing that I really appreciate about him, he seems mature, man. You know, he doesn't seem like the Vic that we've seen in this 30 for 30. You know, he seems like a mature kid, and he takes pride in his craft. So I expect him to take a jump for sure.
What are the lessons you guys take away from the Michael Vick? And if you haven't seen it, ESPN's 30 for 30. It's a two-part series. Right. The first part has aired. I think the second part is airing this week.
I'm not 100% sure. Was it yesterday?
Come on, yesterday. Yeah. Okay. I haven't seen the second part.
I haven't either.
The first part is extraordinary, and you see, first of all, what an unbelievable talent he is. Because Lamar Jackson's great. Lamar can't throw as well as Vic could. I mean, Vic's arm is incredible.
That commercial and the Nike commercial where he throws it out of the stadium, it's not that crazy.
Unbelievable. What's the lesson you take away, though, of what happened in his, basically before he goes to jail?
I feel like he was around the wrong people for too long, and he didn't have anyone that was honest enough to tell him that, yeah, you need to change this up. And he got into this world where no one was willing to challenge him.
Is it that he's not preparing enough? Because from a strictly football sense.
From a football standpoint.
Of not what led him down the road in the dogfight, but strictly from a football standpoint. When I was watching it, I saw the difference between a person whose goal is to be a star and someone who is really driven and compulsive about winning. That Vic got to a place where he was clearly the best player on his team in a city where he was a huge star and he was a national figure. And he wasn't compulsive about winning. Like, it didn't dominate him like the way it seems to dominate Russell Wilson.
Yeah, I think Vic was content with just being the best individual out there. And he didn't have to work as hard as other people. I mean, he wasn't studying. His physical abilities allowed him to be better than everybody else. And then when you're not putting in that work, you're not a leader. So how is your quarterback going to lead a football team? He's exciting. He's going to win some games just off of his ability alone. But he wasn't really challenged. You know, when you can go out there, not study, look at a defense, it doesn't work, forget it, I'm just going to take off and run and make the big play. Everyone pats you on the back. You know, it's all good. And you listen to Jim Mora talk. He said, man, we didn't hold him accountable enough, because it's almost like you don't want to get your superstar mad. You know, you coddle him. You
so
want to
dangerous.
Make sure his ego is intact. You know what I mean? He's a superstar. He's getting all this love. He's getting paid hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, he didn't have a guy to challenge him.
What are you getting paid for as a coach? Like, that is your job. That's what I don't get about the Jim Mora side of things in Atlanta. That is your job, is to get him to work harder. It is your job to challenge him, even if it comes at the expense of him not liking you.
You can't have a guy not listen to you, though. The risk is, and every NBA coach will tell you this, when a guy gets that powerful, he can stop listening, and you're going to be the one that gets fired. And you have that sort of point of, like, he's not listening, and if I'm tougher with him, is that going to make him not listen to me more?
Isn't it funny, though, that now we look at it and we're like, yeah, this was all on Vic. But in the moment, we were probably all saying to ourselves, oh, it's on the coach. And I think that's generally how it goes. Because you can't get that, like, inside information until after the fact.
It's all about player-coach leverage, right? Me as a free agent with Mike Holmgren, I ain't saying nothing. I'm lining up, shut your mouth, head down, come to work every day. Now, a guy like Michael Vick, he's got leverage now. You know, he is the face of the Atlanta Falcons. Ask a bunch of these kids who know Michael Vick who the head coach was when Vick was there. They're not going to be able to tell you who it was. It's always about the players, specifically the quarterback. So he had so much leverage, there was no one who was going to challenge him. And especially none of his friends were going to challenge him. You know, he's paying their bill. You know, moms ain't going to challenge
him. Got like
him.
A frat house, essentially.
Yeah, you know, life was good for him. So I think that's where the organization kind of messed up. They didn't have an old school tough coach to really push Michael Vick to the next level.
It's Danny and Gallant. Michael Bumpus is in with us. And one guy who is unafraid of challenging a superstar, who is willing to go hard in the paint, Shaquille O'Neal, has a hilarious assessment of Joel Embiid, and that's next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
What does Simon say?
He says it's the wheel of non-FL.
Different categories we have. Jersey swapping. Oh, you know what it lands on? It lands on NBA trash talk.
Yes.
I love NBA trash talk.
Love this it. League.
It's fantastic. And Shaquille O'Neal went, as the kids would say, hard in the paint on Joel Embiid. Watching, and this is what I'll give NBA on TNT credit for, is those are players who will actually go out of their way to give you their honest opinion of how young guys are playing.
Yep.
And there's a little bit of salty old man in it, but there's also a little bit of like, these kids today are driving me nuts, which is just fantastic.
Well, you look, they played in the golden age, man. You got Barkley in the late 80s. Early to mid 90s, even some late 90s. You got Shaq in the early 90s. I mean, it's just they played in an era of basketball that was just so much fun to watch. I'm here for it. Go hard on these kids, man.
And the Philadelphia 76ers have become kind of a target. Here is Shaquille O'Neal posting up Joel Embiid.
Embiid is force. Giannis is playing with force, and Embiid is playing SOF capital G. Right here, I'm saying, you know what, I'm not shooting no jumpers, I'm going right at you. Kevin McHale move right there, I don't care who you are. And look, I'm just going at you right now, I'm taking it to your chest. You're 7 foot, so am I, but you're still too little. Jump hooking to death. And right here on the other end, he's not playing with force. He's looking for the foul. He has a little band-aid on his little hand. Oh, he wants the ref to call the foul. The ref don't call the foul, so he runs back on defense like a little baby, and then you let this guy score on you.
A little harsh.
I'm not being harsh.
That's pretty harsh.
I love Ernie Davis. That's kind of harsh, Shaq.
Ernie Johnson absolutely goes right back at him. Is that the worst thing you can call a pro athlete is soft?
Yes, the worst. Basketball, most of these guys are soft anyway. It's basketball. But to be a seven-footer, and what I don't like about Embiid's game is he's always around a three-point line. Everyone wants to shoot threes now. You are 7 feet tall, get your butt in the paint, and get nasty. And Shaq, man, killed him with the accent, too. Why'd he throw the accent on him as well?
I don't know.
It was not a poor imitation of Embiid's speech.
It wasn't.
No. With the Band-Aid on the finger and all those things. The good thing is Embiid will fire back. This idea of the 76ers as being a team that is soft, though, is something Charles Barkley agrees with.
Oh, let me just go ahead and vent now. You know, I picked the Sixers to get to the finals. I think they are the softest, mentally weakest team. It had a bunch of talent. They are the Cleveland Browns of the NBA.
Damn.
They got a lot of talent.
The Browns?
And they talk the talk, and that's it. They want, like, last summer, and I fell for it, too, because one of the guys, one of our bosses is Steve Fiorillo. He had me on the Cleveland Browns bandwagon. So, because, you know, they came out telling everybody how good they were going to be, and then they got punched in the mouth for game one and got punched in them for the rest of the season. The Philadelphia 76ers, my preseason pick to get to the finals, they just talk, Ernie.
Bump winced when he heard him described as the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, it's, you never want to be compared to the Cleveland Browns, one. Two, I agree with them. They're in Philly. Philly's not a soft city. And you know when they really got soft is when they lost the guy everyone was complaining about, Jimmy Butler. As soon as Jimmy left, they have no one who's
going to... Oh, was it Markel Fultz?
Definitely wasn't Markel.
Oh, that's weird. I mean, everyone was complaining about him too, so...
Fultz is playing better now.
Exactly.
He's kind of fixed himself down in Orlando, which is good to see.
Yeah. But you need a guy who's going to step up to the bully and just, you know, talk a little crap, you know, bow up a bit. And they just don't have anybody who does that. Tobias Harris is a nice guy. Al Horford is too old to get in any kind of mix. Ben Simmons is too insecure about his jumper right now. There's no one who's playing real confident basketball on this team.
Ben Simmons is more concerned with, like, the Kardashian that he's dating, probably.
He's not dating a Kardashian, is he?
I don't know. There's, like, the on and off with he and...
Are you serious?
No, do not.
Yeah. That's
even speaking of it reduces his talent, okay?
There's a terrible track record of athletes intersecting with the Kardashian vortex.
Oh, we've seen it with James Harden. His problem is that he just can't quit it, one Ben Simmons. Now, in the case of Joel Embiid, you know, Joel Embiid's one of my favorite players in the NBA because I think that his trash talk is genuine. I think it's actually really funny. But when you trash talk that much, you have to be a hard player. You got to be physical. And the fact that he is not, and we get into this conversation about soft, this is a two-year thing now with the Sixers. We have been calling them soft. Imagine being considered that for multiple years and doing nothing about it to change it. As an athlete, I imagine that would drive me nuts, and I would go out of my way to prove otherwise. I would be trying to send guys to the floor when they're driving in the lane, and yet they don't do that. I understand that sending a message... And by committing a flagrant foul, it's not exactly the best way to go about doing things. But everyone says this about you. Why aren't you doing anything to change the perception?
Yeah, you call me soft, man. I'm going hard. I'm getting a flag. I'm getting a penalty. I'm doing something, and it has to start within. It has to start with Embiid. He's their best player, right? He's supposed to be their leader. So if this was 95, 96, it would have been a clothesline by now. Something would have happened. But you also have to look at the rules of the game and the style of the NBA now. There is no triangle. There is no big man posting up.
Nope.
You can't touch guys anymore. You're going to get flagrant. I mean, I think now it's a combination of the culture that we're in today and then just the rules of the NBA. You cannot foul somebody hard or you're going to lose money and get kicked out of a game.
Here's the other part about the NBA. Is that it's only now starting to matter for a team like Philadelphia. What's happened for the first, we're now really 3.5 months?
The process.
No, it doesn't really matter for a team like Philly that you know is going to make the playoffs. Now they can start toughening up. They started the playoffs last year soft, and I thought got tougher. And watching Embiid cry after they got eliminated from the playoffs, I thought that showed how much he cared. I'll be interested to see if they're tougher in the playoffs this year, but now we're going to start seeing that. The NBA season is 30 games too long.
Yep.
It would be a way better season if it was 50 games because then everybody would have to try. Like right now, it's only now that a team like Philadelphia's got to look around and sort of like, okay, what kind of team are we going to be when we get into the playoffs? Because that's what's going to matter. The one guy to watch on that team, the one guy who is legitimately tough is Mike Scott. He doesn't get a ton of minutes. Like, he's a legitimate wild man.
Didn't he get in a fight with, like, actual Philadelphia fans in a parking lot once?
That's correct, because he's a Washington Redskins fan. And he went and ended up getting punched by somebody and then stood tall in the pocket against, like, five little Eagles, like Joey Bag of Donuts coming in there. Don't you swing on Paulie. He swung on Paulie. I'm going to come after him. And Mike Scott's, I'm not your punk. I'm not your sucker here. Yeah, so I think I'll be interested to see. And that storyline, The best part about it is that Embiid won't let that go quietly. Like, he's going to come back at Shaq and at Barkley. I think it's fantastic.
He's going to come back on the court. At some point, like, stop. Everyone's just abusing you right now.
He's not soft in the way he plays, though.
Like, I agree.
He will stands hit pretty tall. Yes.
But against Giannis, sorry.
Yeah, he got dunked on by Giannis.
That's how you stop Giannis. You have to have physical the Greek freak.
Yeah. I think being tough, too, is, yeah, you play hard, but it's your demeanor, too. Like, it's the way you run down the court. It's the way you post up. It's the way you're communicating on the court. It's the way you're communicating with your teammates and the referees. It's more than just, okay, go down and dunk on a guy. You know, it's slapping the floor when you're playing defense. It's these a bunch of little things, too. And let me point out, you said Mike Scott is tough. I had to look and see what year he was born. I'm like, he's got to be an 80s baby if he's tough. 88, baby. 88. That's why he's tough. Born in the 80s.
Danny and Gallant. We've got Michael Bumpus in. Coming up next, we're going to take a look and talk about Kyle Shanahan doubling down on some mistakes that he made. When you lose a Super Bowl, how do you sell your fan base on the future? I don't think Kyle Shanahan has the answer. We'll see what Paul thinks.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
A wise philosopher once wrote, "I tried too hard and got too far." It was Linkin Park, and that's the story of the San Francisco 49ers 2019 season, everybody. The San Francisco 49ers tried so hard, they got so far. In the end, it didn't really matter, Danny O'Neill.
I like the Linkin Park reference. I'm more preferential to Mike Shinoda. Can I hear it again?
"I tried too hard and got too far. I've become so numb."
Why is it like a bro? Why is it like a frat brother singing it?
Well, I think that's kind of the Linkin Park motif. Yeah, it's from the Jay-Z. I liked it when Jay-Z partners up with them on that one.
So I thought it was like alternative punk. Like, they wouldn't be seen at a frat party. Like, there's no way I'm going to a frat party.
Well, you play it. This is what the frat party plays when there's no one else around.
Now, that part is probably true. They get an E for effort, the 49ers do.
100%.
They get farther than anybody expected. And now they're left with sort of sifting through why they didn't win after having a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter. And some of the second-guessing starts. I think it's going to test the coach and the quarterback the most. Like, those are the two people who are going to face the most scrutiny, who are going to be asked the most about it, and who are going to have to find a way to sort of digest that game and move on from it without snapping at people who bring it up and with kind of keeping their teammates focused on how they can improve from that.
It should be on them, too. Shanahan, he calls the plays, and Jimmy has the most effect on that play. And people are knocking Shanahan. He made some mistakes and questionable calls as far as time management or whatnot. But, and then people are asking why did he trust Jimmy late in the game, whereas these previous two games, only threw the ball like 20-something times or something like that. If you look at Jimmy before the fourth quarter, he was playing okay football. He was doing exactly what he needed to do. So I understand why Shanahan kind of leaned on him towards the end. But if I'm Shanahan, I'm going back to what got us there, which is running the football, run the ball. And he switched up on him. I don't know why.
One of the things about the 49ers this past season was that they were able to be so effective by being balanced. And because they had a really good defense, they could take advantage of moments where the offense, and in particular Jimmy Garoppolo, maybe didn't have his A game. But a lot of people, and I think they expected this to happen. You know these press conferences that happen at the end of the season? I think generally a lot of people that will watch them and sit back that are fans, they're expecting it to essentially be their opportunity to see tomatoes thrown at the people that failed them. And I think they expect hard questions to be thrown at these coaches, general managers, tomato style. Yesterday, we saw both Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch sit in front of a podium and field questions. And there were a lot of people that were like, Kyle, hey, you had all those timeouts at the end of the first half. Why weren't you a little bit more aggressive? And Kyle Shanahan doubled down.
No, absolutely not. I think that was one of the reasons we were up 10 points going into the fourth quarter. Absolutely wanted to call a timeout at that time because we were expecting to be backed up and inside the 10, just like probably should have been at the 1 if they didn't mess that play up. So No, I was as confident as what we did in that situation as anything we've done all year, and I mean that strongly. That's something you work at all for 2 weeks, studying that team, what they're capable of doing. You're not going to give the ball back to them no matter what in that situation. The way he did that third and 15 at the end of the game is how he does a two-minute drive, and felt extremely good with how we went. Not using the timeout there was a no-brainer. But then trying to work the clock. If we would have got an explosive run on the first one, then it would have been a whole different deal. But we got a 2.5-yard run. And so the whole goal was to not let them call a timeout there.
No brainer. I actually agree with him. Much like on the 4th and 11 not going for it call for the Seahawks against the Packers, I agree with him from the perspective of if Kansas City got the ball back and if they didn't run enough time off the clock, you saw how quickly Kansas City can score.
Here's what I would say. The situation that you go through here, they were first, the Chiefs are getting set to punt from about midfield with minute 54, minute 45, kind of somewhere in there to go. And the 49ers have all three timeouts. The cameras show Lynch calling for a timeout. They don't call a timeout. Kansas City runs the ball down, runs the clock down to about a minute. They punt it. San Francisco has the ball first and 20 at their own 20, or first and 10 at their own 20, three timeouts. And then they run the ball. And when they don't get a big gain, they let the clock tick more. They then throw the pass down the sideline. It looks like Kittle catches it for a huge gain, and they're in field goal range. And instead, it's offensive pass interference, and they run out the clock. Here's what I don't get. Why do you take that approach in that moment, and then in the fourth quarter, when you've got a lead, you start having Jimmy Garoppolo throw the ball? Why do you take that approach instead of having... Hey, if you're going to trust Jimmy Garoppolo, have him do it at the end of the first half when you got all your timeouts. Instead, they were like, we're not going to trust him here, but we're going to trust him in an even more leveraged, important spot.
Yeah, I think it's more complicated than people might think. I think that football is such an emotional game, an emotional roller coaster. Your offense is on the field. Say they go 3-and-out. They punt the ball. The first thing you do is get feedback from your guys. You talk to your line. How are we feeling? How's that? How's their push? You talk to your quarterback. What are you seeing? What do you like? You talk to your receivers. What do you guys like? What can you beat them on? What shouldn't we run anymore? So there's constant communication going on. And then you're talking to the guys upstairs who are overseeing it all. What do you guys see? We're seeing this. We're seeing that. So I appreciate that Kyle Shanahan doubled down on his decision making, because now he's doubling down on all the conversations he's had with his quarterback, with his offensive line, with his receivers, with the guys upstairs. If he goes back and says, oh, man, horrible call, we should have did this, should have did that, which he could have done, and people would have been appeased by it. Okay, yeah, he's admitting faults or whatnot. But I kind of think he's taking a stance on, look, this was our game plan. This is what we wanted to do. This is what we thought was going to work at that time. You have to go with your gut. You have to go with what's being communicated throughout your organization. So, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and when you lose, and especially when you lose the way that they did, you're gonna have to answer a lot of questions. But I respect a man who stands in front of the crowd, takes all the bullets, and says, "Look, this is what we want to do. I'm not gonna tell you why we did it, but I believe in our decision making."
I admire him for sticking to his convictions there too. And I mean, he was asked a little bit later about the blowback, and he says he doesn't feel any of that blowback. Now, I wonder too, as a coach, you know, people are talking bad about you. And you want to keep doing things the way that you believe is the right way to do it. But I do wonder about that element of, even if you don't hear the outside noise, or you put your head in the sand so you don't hear it at all, if there's an element where after a loss like this, you start questioning yourself. Because there should be, don't you think, Bob?
Yeah, you always question yourself. Even after wins, you're going to look at the film and say, well, I probably should have done this. But you're not going to tell the public, you know,
right,
what I mean?
Obviously, yeah.
You know, you can have a... You have a bad day with your girl. You're not gonna come on the air and be like, "Man, me and my lady had a rough day today." You know what I mean? That's just not what you do. You always protect your team and your family, and I think that's what he's doing. And he made it to the Super Bowl. Two teams made it to the Super Bowl. So for all the guys knocking him, hating him, I get it. He's going to change some things. I think that he's been a coach his whole life. He's been around football his whole life. He knows the process. You go back, you watch the film, you dissect it. He's probably watched that game 4 or 5 times already and has come up with things that he would have done differently and things that he wants to change. But end of the day, you protect your boys and you double down.
We got to double down on more Michael Bumpus. Michael Bumpus, thanks for joining us.
Fun to have you in here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you guys.
You have a great weekend. He is Michael Bumpus, Danny O'Neill, Paul Gallant. It's Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle. The Seahawks, guess what? They didn't finish very strong at the end of this year. Yeah, they won a playoff game, but they lost the second one. How did the Seahawks finish strong going forward? Danny's got the answer for you next. Danny Engelant, 710 ESPN Seattle.